approve the floor field version of Wick's theorem. Wick's theorem says that if you have the basic thing you need is that the time ordered product of a bunch of fields, say we have n fields here, that time ordered product can be written as a normal ordered product plus some smaller normal ordered products times d propagators d plus some smaller normal ordered products and so on. So you get a normal ordered product of all n fields. And then I have to check the normalization of this. But you just get equally weighted versions that at least in this case. Yeah, let me do four here. In that case, I know that there are all the coefficients are 1 for the general form of Wick's theorem. I'm not sure if you get any numeric coefficients here or not. But then you're going to have things like phi 1, phi 2 normal ordered times the propagator d3, 4. So x3 minus x4. Here, when I write something like phi 1, what I really mean is phi of the 4 vector x1, and so on. These propagators, d of x1 minus x2, for example, that's what I'm calling d1, 2, and that's the thing we got last time. Where is it? It's the Green function for the wave equation. It's this four-dimensional integral over momentum of I to some power, and we've got I over V squared minus M squared plus I epsilon, and a phase, I believe, 2 pi to the 4th and e to the minus I. Okay. 2 pi to the 4th, e to the minus I, e to the minus I. x1 minus x2. There we go. So the propagator for any two of the coordinate variables, x1, x2, x3, x4, you can write a propagator of this sort as an integral over momentum. And then when you look at the time ordered product, okay, you end up writing all these fields in a certain order. And you rearrange the fields. And Wick showed that what you're able to do is take every combination of normal ordering times propagators. So if we have the normal ordering of phi 1, phi 3, then the propagator's got to be x2 minus x4. And let's see, so 1, 2, 1, 3, we ought to have a 1, 4. X2 minus X3, and then we've got a 2, 3, and a 2, 4, there's another bunch more, right? Get them all down. Phi 2, phi 3 with a D, I'll abbreviate now, 1, 4, D1, 4. We'll have a phi 2, phi 4 normal order times a D1, 3. And finally, we have a 5, 3, 5, 4 normal order with a D1, 2. And then last, we reduce the number of normal order fields by 2. That leaves us none. And we have D1, 2 with D3, 4. And we write this every way we can. And there are 3. D1, 3, D2, 4. And D1, 4, D2, 3. So, we generalize this. You can do a proof by induction if you can stand to work through all of the commutators. But the thing that happens is when you take a vacuum expectation value of this, all of the normal order terms drop out, and you're just left with that, which is what you're supposed to prove here. So the exercise is a matter of writing out the time order fields, expanding in the plus or minus parts like we did for the field, using commutators wherever you need to produce normal ordered things plus change, and that change is the stuff that the propagators are made of. So, yeah, that might not be too bad to show. What I want to do is...
What is the reason that all of the normal order aspects drop out?
Okay. Where if we take anything normal ordered between vacuum states, so we've got any normal ordered combination of fields here. All right. I claim we're going to get zero. Okay, so there are three cases. We've got a bunch of A daggers and we've got a bunch of A's. Vacuum expectation. So, the generic case, you have some A daggers and some A's. The normal ordering just means you're pushing only A's to the right. So, if you have some A's, any A acting on the vacuum state gives zero. So, something like that is immediately zero. So, there's case one. Case two, alright, let's get rid of the A's, and suppose we only have A daggers, but A dagger acting to the left on zero is dual to A acting to the right on zero, which is zero. That implies that zero to the left of an A dagger has to vanish. So if we don't have any A's, it's zero, and the third case is just like the first case, where we don't have any A daggers, we just have A's, that has to be zero. So in each possible case, there's something that's going to be zero. So an advantage of having gotten to the vacuum here is that there's a bunch of stuff we don't have to worry about at all, like there's something to do. What we're left with are these propagators, and we're going to introduce a diagrammatic way of looking at these propagators. So, starting with the diagram, something like D1, 2, D3, 4 is a case where a particle goes from X1 to X2, another particle goes from X3 to X4, and that diagram for that product of propagators. So if we just had remember we're computing matrix elements of the scattering matrix. If we just had that one term right there, we would be calculating the probability of scattering associated with a particle that goes from here to here, a particle that goes from there to there. There's no interaction, so the T matrix ought to be zero. And we'll go through that, and it will be. So, you know, if we have two initial particles, two final particles, and they don't do anything, there was no scattering. This gets interesting when we put in that Hamiltonian. Remember, we've got the exponential of the integral of the interaction Hamiltonian. That interaction Hamiltonian will be the thing that will make these diagrams non-trivial. So let's just work through that. Any questions on Wick's theorem? We did the two field example completely explicitly last time, and I'm sure the proof for all of the higher ones is the same, only to be exponentially more complicated if you add fields. The general proof can be done by induction, certainly, and apparently it's done in Teschen and Schroeder, probably some other fields, very books too. Maggie already mentioned Teschen and Schroeder. It may be that all you need for the general case is just some clever way of keeping track of which commutators you need. I don't know. You may see the pattern doing this, and if you do, go ahead and figure out the whole thing. So, let's do an example. Let's see. Did you get everything in the picture?
I've done a lot. Are you going to do more on the right? Or that part of this?
Well, let's see. I can make it part of the...
I can just...
All right. Well, what I'm thinking is to start the problem, it'd be nice to just have the whole board take us to one.
Okay.
So I want to consider a situation where we have two particles in and two particles out, and we'll look at lambda phi to the fourth. I hope everybody was ready there. So, get that. Let's see, I did get... all the stuff you sent me online last night.
Okay.
So it's there. And suppose it's still there. initial particles with momentum K1 with four vectors. K1, K2. Let me be sure I'm using the same. Initial K, and then final moment. P1 and P2. So two particles in, two particles out. We need to specify the interaction Hamiltonian. And let's take it to be phi to the fourth. Oh, now there was one thing that I didn't show previously. The relationship between the interaction Hamiltonian and the interaction phi. Right, this is very simple. Let's just make a note. If H interaction is polynomial in the field in phi, that polynomial, then hi at phi I is the same, how to say this, H is the same function of phi I as H interaction is of phi. And the proof is simple. H I is going to be an exponential. Okay, this is a plus or minus on the left. For our interaction picture. Let me just remember that. Interaction picture, where'd it go? There it is. Okay, plus I H naught here. Let's just say some time interval tau, and then we have H interaction, and we have E to the minus I H naught. Tau might be some T minus T naught, something like that. But then this is going to be lambda over 4 factorial e to the I H naught tau. And then we've got phi to the fourth here. Phi, and phi, or P phi O and mom, e to the minus I H naught tau. And what we do is we insert identities between each of these where the identity can be written as e to the minus I h naught tau times e to the I h naught tau, and each phi turns into a phi I. So, see it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to, all right, this is one.
Yeah, I see that.
Okay, I'm going to stick that one, three copies, one between each pair here, and then, yeah, no, let me do the first one explicitly. I, H naught, tau, we've got a phi, and now I stick an identity, minus I, H naught, tau, e to the I, H naught, tau, phi, and so on. Now I group it this way. That was my identity here.
Sure.
But this is phi I, the interaction picture field. So what I'm going to end up with is four copies of the interaction picture field with the same constants here. So I'm going to have four of these, which is still lambda over 4 factorial phi to the 4th. It's the same functional dependence that we started with for H interaction.
But those aren't identical, are they? They're all different phis?
These phis are different than those phis, because these phis are exactly that combination right there. Right, so they're the original phi time evolved with the free Hamiltonian. That's our interaction picture thing. So, what we get here is that Hi is lambda over 4 factorial phi I to the 4th when phi interaction was the original phi to the 4th. And that's the concept. So, yeah, these are different things than those, but these are the ones we need. We've managed to write this in terms of those. And writing H sub I turns out to be a very easy thing to do in most circumstances. That's really the point here. So let's study this theory to zeroth order and then.
Can I re-ask my question?
Yes.
Previously we had subscripts on our phi. And now these are all looking very
These are at some positions here, Ryan. And by the time we write these in some time ordered product, we'll let each of these four or five be evaluated in some different position. Let's see, is that true? No. These four are all in the same position. The ones in the time ordered product are different positions. Those are the, let's see, are they integrated over? How did we get different positions for each of those five? We had these time-ordered products.
We had states of multiple products, right? So we were trying to pull out all the different momenta.
We were
trying to get to the vacuum state. Isn't that where those phis came out from? Different
right. Okay, so those phis come from using creation and annihilation operators to pull out the different momenta. The different momenta bring in different position coordinates. So in the string of fields we get in that time-ordered product, each position argument is different. In the Hamiltonian, it's going to be the same. So, this will become clearer as we write down the problem. We're going to work through a scattering problem. So, you'll see that these will be the same. The phi is multiplying, it will be different. So, hang on with that and see if it doesn't become clear. Alright, so, let's see. 546 and 567. Let's just see if those look familiar. Yeah, that's an equation we had in the box. So we're interested in the matrix elements of major. So what we have is a final state, T1, T2, then the T matrix, and the initial state, K1, K2. Right, that's the thing we want to compute. And recall the general formula we derived had products over... We put some of the normalization on this side, and that will turn out to have been a nice idea. We get products of T squared minus M squared, I equals 1 to 2 over the final particle, J equals 1 to 2 over the initial particles, KI squared, or KJ squared minus M squared. So we have these poles, but, you know, on the solutions to the classical field equation, those are poles, they blow up, or actually you multiply by them and get zero. So it's convenient to stash them on this side of the equation. What we showed is that we can write this as, a whole bunch of integrals. This is equation 546 that I'm writing. We derived it, agreed with the text on it. But it's a product of integrals over all the positions of the four fields times the interaction Hamiltonian. So all of this is equal to, and now we have a product of four integrals, but I'm going to write it all out here. D4, X1, D4, X2. These all came from creation operators out of this and annihilation operators out of that and rewriting that in terms of the field. And we're left with these integrals. Then we have e to the I, then plus t2 x2 minus k1 x3 minus k2 x4, and then we have this big fraction thing, which is our vacuum expectation value, and that normalization, that e to the I alpha normalization that we came up with for it. So here we have a time-ordered product of phi of x1, phi of x2, phi of x3, and phi of x4. And then we have our interaction Hamiltonian. Where'd it go here? So exponential minus I and the interaction Hamiltonian we just showed is lambda over 5 to the 4th integral d4x phi, and this is the interaction phi of x to the 4th. And then close our time ordering and put our vacuum state on there. So that's the e to the integral of the interaction Hamiltonian term. And we're going to treat this perturbatively. I'm going to expand this exponential in powers of lambda, and we're only going to do the lambda equal 0, lambda equal 1 term, so we won't have to worry too much about that. The other thing he notes here is that we can take the equals 1. It turns out that z is 1 plus order lambda squared, which, since we're only going to work the first order in lambda, that will be about equal to 1. For this calculation. If we were doing higher order perturbation, we'd have to keep that that higher order term, if it's a convenient normalization. Yeah.
Are we missing the normalization on the last?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. It's just the time ordered product of the Hamiltonian term. So. Where jaws covers multitude of spins. Integral d4 x phi to the fourth of x. And at some point in all of this, Maggiore has dropped the I subscript on the phis because the only phis we're using are interaction picture phis. So at this point, if we stop putting the subscript on phis, you just have to remember that it really is phi phi. They'll all be interaction picture phis. Okay, so how are we going to compute this? Order by order. In lambda. So lambda to the zero. We can handle that. What we need is to compute all this stuff when we expand in lambda, we've got 1 plus that integral plus higher order stuff. At zeroth order, we just have a 1 there. So we need the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of 4 fields, phi of x1 through x4. And then we're going to integrate that over everything in sight, d4x1, d4x2, x3, and x4. And we've got this exponential floating around. Anything else we need to write in there? And then the normalization is just 1. So that part is done.
So.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused because it's lambda to the. Like, I would think lambda to 0 is 1, not lambda equals 0. Or what?
This exponential. All right.
Okay,
so
we're expanding.
What I've done is expand the exponential, right? So we've got I lambda over 4 factorial integral d4 x phi 4 is equal to 1 minus I lambda over 4 factorial d4 x phi 4 plus 2 factorial minus I lambda over 4 factorial squared, and then a pair of integrals.
Okay.
X prime. And so on. So we're looking at this term for 1. It's not going to give us anything. It's going to go away.
Okay.
All right. If, you know, it's as if there were no interaction. And if there's no interaction, this thing just gives us the vacuum expectation of the 4 fields. We've got 4 D's in there. But what's going to happen is this scattering amplitude is going to be killed by these things. Right, when we multiply by those denominators and impose the field equation, we'll find the whole thing vanish. So, yeah, remember, it's this thing we're computing, and this thing is proportional to t squared minus m factors when we multiply those back to this side. So those are what are going to mean nothing happens at zeroth order.
Is M going to be constant from the initial to final state?
M, the mass?
Yeah.
We're only talking about one kind of particle here, some scalar particle phi. So we've got four of them here, and they come together and they do some sort of interaction, and you know, two of them fly out. So they may have they may have done any number of things in between, depending on what order we're dealing with here. You'll see how these calculations bring in bring in mixtures of these particles with those particles. Right. At zeroth order, we just get the propagators from those two. But when we start getting propagators that mix, say, x1 with this x or that x prime, then we're going to see things start to happen. Okay, so this back in expectation value, we just use Wick's theorem, and we have a D12 and a D34, and we have a D13 and a D24, and we have a D14 and a D23. So we're in a position to feel comfortable with that idea. So we know what to stick in. We stick in these poles. And now we've got to write this thing out, I'm afraid. Let's look at the first term. So we've got the integral of, what do these propagators look like? Can we write them out? No, we don't quite need to yet. D of x1 minus x2. D of x3 minus x4. So we have things like this. Then we have this exponential. And what else have we got? Is that everything? That might be everything for this one. Yeah, we've got the D's. There are two other terms that look like that. So, yeah, now what we need to do is a change of variable. So, let's let x equal x1 minus x2 and let's call the other capital X. Be the average x1 plus x2 over 2, and now what happens when we write this thing out? And then we're integrating over d4 of all of the coordinates. So what happens? We're going to get things like, okay, t1x1 plus t2x2 in terms of, it's essentially center mass coordinates, something like that. So let's just invert this. So if we have 2 times capital X plus little x, that's going to be equal to, let's see, 2, that's going to be twice x1, because the x2 is canceled. So we can write x1 as center mass plus half little x. Then x2 is going to be presumably the difference, yeah. So it will be capital X minus a half little x. So this combination with momenta is going to be P1 plus P2 times capital X. Those are four-dimensional dot products, you know, Lernstein dot products, plus these guys will have a half and now we'll have T1x minus T2x. So T1 minus T2 with little x. Good. And then the D's simplify. D of x one minus x two that becomes D of x. That's simpler. And let's see, we're going to do the same thing with the k's. Now the k integrals and the x one, x two, and the x three, x four is going to separate here. So I'm going to call this I one. So I can write I one as all right. We have a d of x. We have the exponential of this stuff. I t one plus t two capital x. Then e to the I over two t one minus t two little x. D four of little x, D four of big X. Let's see, does that give us the same volume form? We might need some factors of two. Let's see, D four of big X. Looks to me like we're going to need factor of 2 to the 4th somewhere. Is that right? Dx1 dx. Yeah, I'm thinking we need a 2 to the 4th here. Is that right? Well, he doesn't have it. Or not. Let's think about what D4X looks like. So, the volume element here. All right. Remember what's back into this. We've got X, Y, Z, and T in each of these. So, a simple DY, right, that's just, let's see. So, got a dy1 times a dy2. So we're going to have an x1, y1, z1, and t1, and an x2, y2, z2, t2 for these integrals. Let's just look at the y component. And what happens in terms of these new variables? All right, so the y component here is going to be d of a capital Y plus 1/2 D of little y for dx1. So that's dx1, or sorry, that's dy1. Then dy2 is going to be a similar thing. Let's see, what do we call this? Another D capital Y. Why do we have two of these?
It's the same, right?
Minus a half D. Why? Let's see. So, what is that? Let's do a wedge product here. Yeah, dy, you don't integrate. Right, the only thing we're going to get here is a half dy, the little y wedge, the big y, minus a half the little y wedge, the big y, which is the dy wedge, the big y. Okay, that's it. So the normalization. comes out right. So we're going to get this four times, one for x, y, z, and t, so each component of the four vector. But yeah, the normalization works out right because it's cross terms that you want there. You need the half to get that normalization thing. That's probably why the half is there.
What is the y again?
Okay, y is the second spatial component of this thing. Okay, so x1, what I'm saying is x1 is actually a four vector, c1, x1, y1, z1. And I chose to do y because it's not x.
Oh, okay.
So we don't have too many x's. So I'm just looking at one of these guys.
Okay.
And then similarly for the two.
I'm doing the same trick as over here with the x equals x1, x2. We're going for the y's, or sort of.
This is what I'm working on, right? I'm still figuring out this coordinate transformation. What I'm looking at is this volume element in terms of these new variables. But these new variables are really four vectors.
Right.
So I'm looking at one component of the four vector, the dy, dy part, dy1, dy2 part here.
Okay.
So I want to write that out in terms of the y component of the new variables.
So is the capital Y like analogous to the capital X?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is like X1, Y, Z, T, or something like that. So I'm working with this one and that one. Confusing notation because we've dropped all these indices and don't really have labels for them.
Okay.
So,
wasn't the weight on
all that? Oh, it's an anti-symmetric product to make it a volume form. Yeah, we did differential forms, another term, so it didn't see we're there at that point. If I was going to get rid of the dy squared, which is not what you integrate, the terms that contribute to a volume element are just the anti-symmetric piece of the product. So the wedge does that for you. Okay, does everyone see what I've done? Does anyone see what I've done? Okay. About them. But you okay? All right. So I'm just checking that I've written a volume form here and that I don't need some factors of 2. And I don't because we just get the cross terms twice to cancel the 2, and that's undoubtedly why the 2 was put there in the first place, the half. So this half is just what we need to come out with the same volume form. Okay, so then we have a similar thing for the other two variables. He probably called these the Y or something, doesn't he? What's he call them? No. They're still... Wait a minute. Yeah, for X3 and X4. So, I need a name for those as well. Let's just say same for K1, K2. He continues to use capital X and lower X in this integral. That's confusing because it's not correct. It should be X3 plus or minus X4 over here. And we should have a different name for it, and I'm not going to make up yet another X. So we do the same thing here for the K terms in the X3 minus X4 that we're doing here for X1 and X2. So let's figure out this integral. So... let's call this I1t and I1k, and just look at the t integral. What do we get? All right, we know the propagators is, where's the propagator? I had it written down somewhere. Did I erase it? I guess I erased it. What do these propagators look like?
Integral.
So, but I'll do it in side over here. So dx is with an integral d4t over 2 pi to the 4. Then we had I e to the minus I t x over t squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. It was that thing. And we want to do the integral over x. We did one integral from that the other day, but I don't think that's what we need to do. We want to combine it with this thing, but we're going to integrate over x. So it looks to me like we're going to get a delta function in t minus this momentum difference, which I don't think is what it's writing down. So there may be more steps to all this. What we can do is this integral. So we still have a d of x, which is given by that. Then we have e to the I over 2 t1 minus t2 little x. D4 little x. But then this d4x with that is a delta function. That's a Dirac delta function times 2 pi to the 4. Del 4 of t1 plus t2. And, see, is that going to help us? Let me see where the p goes. Let's see, we've got an integral over p there, but we have some denominator. Where does it go? It looks to me like he's working in the Fourier transform space. Did we miss something here? If we do the little x integral first, we're going to get another delta function. So we'll still have the d4p. The 2 pi to the fourth factors go away. And there's an I over p squared minus m squared. And then this exponential and that exponential give us a 2 pi to the fourth del 4 of what? Well, this t minus that difference. So P minus P1 minus P2 over 2, like that. Did I get everything? Did I miss any term? But we can do that D4P, and it's going to replace this P by that difference. The I. Yeah, the I is in here. It's just part of the propagator.
I mean,
It's still there if we need it.
Oh.
But because we've got a delta function, we're going to set this equal to other stuff. We're not actually going to do that integral.
Oh.
If we were going to do this integral over that pole without a delta function, then we would need that to know where the poles are. But because we've got the delta function, we don't need it. So what we get here looks like 2 pi to the 4th times I over P1 minus P2 over 2 squared minus M squared.
Doesn't agree with what he's got, but does it?
Did we miss another delta function? Oh, we lost this one. Delta P1 plus P2. Okay, that's better. This delta for P1 plus P2. Alright, that's that. I can set P2 equal to minus P1, so I get 2P1 here, and the 2 cancels. So I can write this equivalently as 2 pi to the 4th times I over P1 squared minus M squared times del 4 of P1 plus P2. There. And I think that does agree. Yeah, that's good. We get the same result for the k. And the k integral is just like this. So, were we commenting last time that in field theory you use like everything you know from everywhere? it's like that. You just have to pull out all the stops and use all the tricks. Every mathematical tool at your disposal had better be at your disposal or you're not going to get there. Okay, any questions on that? I think I've muddled it through in my own head, but let me take some time to answer any questions.
Are there just two integrals or are there eight?
Well, let's see. Let's count integrals. All right. We have a d4x and a d4 capital X, so that's 8.
That's 8.
And then,
there's
the same number on this.
Okay.
And this d contains another 4, so that's the 4 dimension. So we did 12 integrals now.
But we did 1 of the 12, or did we do
we
all?
We did all 12.
Oh, really?
All right, because it's a 4-dimensional delta function here, so you can do 4 at once. Right, so you do all 4 of the momentum direction. I integrated over this 4-dimensional delta. So, let me tell you where the 12 went, right? We did a d4 of little x, and we're only integrating this exponential. In each of those 4 dimensions, you get a Dirac delta times 2 pi, so you get these 4 Dirac delta functions. Now, doing the 4 p integrals is easy because you've got 4 Dirac delta functions. So you just make this replacement in the expression here. And so we've done 8 integrals. Where are the other 4? Oh, we'd already done 4. To get to here, this delta function was the 4 capital X integral. So we did those 4 fours first, turn this into 4 deltas. We did the little x 4 integral second to get those 4 deltas. So now we've got 8 delta functions for doing 8 integrals. Then the last 4 of the 12 integrals, we integrate over 4 of those delta functions. and we're still left with four delta functions and this fold. Should we need to integrate around that, we can always add a plus I epsilon. You know, it's there if we need it, but we're not going to. Other questions? Yes? Okay, so let's back up over here and see why I want to move forward. I1 is the first of three terms. I1 is made up of I1t and I1k and gives us 2 pi to the fourth I. So I. And we're going to get that twice because we have it for the k's as well. Then we have a couple of poles. We have a p1 squared minus m squared that we just did. We're going to get a k1 squared minus m squared. That works the same way. It comes from I1k. Then we have two delta functions. Del 4 at of p1 plus p2. Del 4 of p1 plus k1 plus k2. And we've done the first of these three terms. The other ones are going to look very similar. We need similar substitutions, but already we can see that this matrix element is going to vanish. Let's check this. So we put this in, and if we're solving for p1, p2, then we have the I times the scattering part of the scattering matrix and k1 times k2. What's that equal to? Well, here we have these products. We're going to have 1 over I root z, I root z. I told you we can take z equal 1, so that's not going to do much. Then we have product of p squared minus m squared thing. So we have p1 squared minus m squared, p2 squared minus m squared, k1 squared minus m squared, k2 squared minus m squared. That's just multiplying these things over onto the other side. And now we've just done all of these integrals for the zeroth order term for this first one. And what we find is this. So we have times, let me put quantity, 2 pi 4 I, 2 pi 4 I over p1 squared minus m squared times k1 squared minus m squared, then two delta functions, p1 plus p2, k1 plus k2, plus two more terms. Right, where the two more terms come from the d1, 3, d2, 4, and the d1, 4, d2, 3. And we'll find they're similar, but here's the thing that happens. We can cancel these two poles. But we're left with two things that vanish. Okay, when we set the conservation of momentum at the end, the k2 squared equal to m squared, or k2 squared equal to m squared at the end of the calculation, those terms are going to go to zero. So this goes to zero, this goes to zero. So what we find is the whole thing equals zero. Now, does this make sense? Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, because look, what we're computing is p1, p2. Remember, we had the S matrix here, K1, K2, but F is all the stuff that goes straight through plus the stuff that scatters. T is only the scattered stuff, right? Where K1 and K2 are not equal to P1 and P2, some scattering has happened. Well, we've thrown out that term, so it better be zero because no scattering happened in this. This is where the particles just go through. Remember, it lands at zero, there's no interaction, so nothing happened.
This is just for the first term, right?
We've just done the first term,
okay,
yes.
Okay.
But in fact, let's see. Let's see. How should we think of this? Do another one.
Okay.
Exercise. The author assures us that if you repeat for V13, V24. Now, yeah, the thing that's funny there is, you know, we're going to be mixing P's and K's, right? So a 1-3 term is going to mix these two, but you're still going to get a bunch of delta functions. And I'll work through it if you want to see it. But let's read what he says about this. We get a contribution. The same happens for the other contributions indicated by the dot. Okay. So the claim is you'll get zero for the other two as well.
Okay.
But that would be a good exercise. That'd be a good way to firm up this calculation in your mind. Perfectly good practice putting in all these factors and carrying out these delta function integrations. You notice we did 12 integrations very quickly here. We're not actually integrating anything but direct delta functions, so as long as you keep track of stuff, it's not so hard. The hardest bit was getting the coordinate transformation right, so you're going to have to, you know, you're going to be mixing X2 and X3 or something in these other ones, but you're still going to choose some center of mass type coordinates. You'll still be doing the same sort of thing. So, we are assured that goes to zero. And,
what was the argument for these two terms going to zero?
The last two? These two?
No,
these were you noted. Well, P2 squared is M squared.
Right.
We made an argument earlier that there were going to be some cancellations here, that this whole calculation is done what's called off mass shell, where we don't assume yet, as we do this calculation, that P squared is M squared, but in fact we know it is. So at the end of the calculation, we set P squared to M squared. And in this case, that gives us a bunch of zeros. Now, when we do the first order calculation, we put in the interaction terms. Now, all four of these are going to cancel, and we won't have that zero. So we're ending up with some extra ones that go to zero because we didn't do any scattering. And once the scattering comes in, that'll be different. And in fact, it's interesting how that works. So that's probably the next thing to do. Ready to try lambda, order lambda?
Do you know where the terminology on the math shell comes from?
Yeah. What you're looking at is, or I think in momentum space, the set of four vectors P with magnitude squared M squared lie
on four.
It's actually a hyperboloid.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but you know, I mean, you think of a sphere of radius M, right? So the momentum has a length that lies on that shell.
Okay.
Right, instead of inside or outside.
Okay.
And it's actually not an XL, but a hyperbole.
Hyperbole. Four dimensions.
Yeah, okay. Four dimensions. And, you know, and that is the standard nomenclature.
Okay.
Any other questions before we launch into the next order? You good? We'll try it. We got all the pictures. You got all the notes you want?
I don't have the new stuff.
Okay.
Everything else is okay.
All right. I'm just thinking starting way at the left is probably a good idea.
Okay.
Happens here is it's much the same except we've got 8 5 instead of 4, and that thought might be enough to send one screaming to the wings, but not too bad. So we have order lambda. What do we do? Let's see, the right-hand side, let's call that, I'm going to call it time one.
First of the 3D,
guys. Right. So, let's first look at integral, back to an expectation value, time-ordered product, of what? So we've got 4, 5, five x 2, 5 x 3, 5 x. You can think of these as the external lines. These are the things that are measured. So you have particles going from some initial position into the interaction region, and then two more coming out. So two of these are going in and two of these are going out. Could be any of the ones going in and any going out, depending on the time order. Then, at order lambda only, we just have that exponent. So we're going to pick up a factor of minus I lambda over 4 factorial times phi of x to the 4th, and I'll just leave it as an unnumbered x. And then, in the time ordering, let's put our vacuum expectation. And what else do we have? Right, we've got all those exponentials, and we've got a whole bunch of before x. So e to the I. P1 x1 plus P2 x2 minus P, whoops, K. K1 x1 minus K2, K1 x3, K2 x4, all that. That exponential doesn't come in, but we've expanded that and set higher order powers of lambda to zero. Then we have some d4 of every x in phi, d4 x1, d4 x2, d4 x3, d4 x4, and d4 of the unnumbered x, the one on the phi to the fourth. Okay, so now the time ordered product. Alright, we're going to get various things, okay? So we're going to get a D12 and a D34 and some D of zero things, whatever that is. Well, that might or might not diverge. But the problem with those, if we form propagators out of X1, X2, and X3, X4, it's going to manage just like it did before. We're still going to get that same thing. And then this integrated over x just gives some modulation of the whole thing. The only way we get something new here is when we look at all eight of these and we pair up the x1 with the x and the x2 with an x and the x3 with an x and the x4 with an x. If we look at propagators between the numbered x's, it's going to get a zero because it's not going to cancel those p squared minus m squared factors. So the only things that contribute are things that have a D, X1 minus X, this kind of thing, X2 minus X.
Let me just double check that we're thinking of this in the same way. Yeah, exactly this.
Okay, the only thing is, there are four factorial of these, because I can pair x1 with any one of these x's, x2 with any one of the remaining three, x3 with one of the remaining two, and x4 goes with the last one. So there are four factorial ways to do that pairing, so we're going to come up with a numerical four factorial here.
Why doesn't the time ordering take care of?
Well, the time ordering is what produces these. In order to turn the time ordering into normal ordering, the commutators produce these. And, you know, phi 2 is going to have to pass some of those, some number of those. And phi 3 is going to have to pass some of those. And that's what gives rise to these. But you get all combinations. But they all end up looking the same, because these are just numbers now. So those all commute. They're all the same weight. So then that replaces the time ordering factor. We get rid of the four factorial, that's why it was there in the first place. We have a minus I lambda. So if we call this thing I, then I is going to be equal to the integral d4x1, d4x2, d4x3, d4x4. And then we have a minus I lambda I can pull out. And then we have these d's and that exponential. So let's write it again. D of x3 minus x, d of x4 minus x, and the exponential of I T1 x1 plus T2 x2 minus K1 x3 minus K2 x4. So that's our integral. I forget what we did with it. What do we do with it next? We've got to put in all these d's, I suppose, and start integrating and being clever about how we change coordinates.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Can I see from this, just this prior step, that this is why there's no phi to the third?
We can do phi to the third theory.
Okay.
Let's see.
Do you always get a zero, though, because one of those d's...
Let's see. To get a phi to the third theory, you either are going to have to go to second order, so you have an even number of parts. To have two particles in and two particles out in a phi 3 theory, you're going to have to go to second order in lambda.
Okay.
So you have an even number of things.
Okay.
If you have two particles in and one out,
then
you can get first order.
Okay.
So, yeah, you're thinking this right up.
Okay.
So let me think how we do these integrals or spirit of what happens here. Four factorial. So we write this. And... Okay, so let's do one of the integrations. The deal here is to call this thing y1. So you want to get your d's evaluated. You want the argument of d to be one of your integration variables. That simplifies things. So we can find that again.
Are we missing one of the integration, one of the volume elements? We still need 5, right? The d4 or just
d4x. D4x, yeah. Okay.
D4x.
The X's and the 5 and the 4.
Yeah, the Hamiltonian has measure for over all of these. Oh,
okay.
So that gives us this.
Oh, right.
So now we're at 20 integrals. And so let's see. What are we going to do for the other one? Now, presumably we can do a similar sort of trick, but we don't have a... let's see, this could give us a P1. So, let's call it I1 is minus I lambda, let me just define this integral to be the integral over D4X1, and we've got D of X1 minus X. And we're going to have an e to the I p1 x1. That's all of the x1s around, so that's the whole integral. So we'll see if we can do that. Let me just notice if there are any particular tricks to... D of Y1, and we have E to the I P1, but now X1 can be replaced by Y1 plus X. So, what is D of Y1? Well, it's this integral over here. So we'll have a D4 of let's see, what's this depend on? It some new index D, not P1. So I'll just call it D. Then I e to the minus I P Y1 it's going to be, because we want D of Y1. And then the denominator is P squared minus M squared plus I epsilon if we need it, and we're hoping we don't. So then that D, and then we have another EVI P1 Y1 plus X. We also have the D4P and D4 Y1. So clearly we want to do the Y1 integral. That's going to give us the Dirac delta in P1 minus T, or P minus P1. So the 2 pi to the 4th will go away because we're picking up 4 delta functions. We're left with D4P. We have an e to the I P1X over P squared minus M squared, because those don't have Y1. So then the Y1 integral, the I is still here. And then we have del 4 of P minus P1. So we do the integral over P, and it's going to set all of the P's equal to P1. So we just get e to the I e to the I P1X over P1 squared minus M squared. Well, that wasn't so bad. Can we do that with all 4 of them? I don't actually see any reason why not. So, concatenating all 4, our total integral over here, we do a similar substitution on each one. We have exponentials. Since the momentum comes in squared, I don't think we're going to have issues with the sign of
k, because we're only taking the norm squares here, this exponential, where it occurs, will have minus signs on the k, but the numbered x's are all going to get replaced by the unnumbered x. So we have the product of four of these things. I to the fourth, e to the I, t1 plus t2 minus k1 minus k2, all with x, over a product of, now, four of these guys, 2 squared minus m squared, k1 squared minus m squared. So I'm arguing that there's no sign to occur in that factor. K2 squared minus m squared. And we have one remaining d4x in all of this. And there's an overall minus I lambda. So let me back this off. And I think we've got the whole thing. Notice what we get here. The x integral is going to give us a Dirac delta function that conserves energy momentum. Right? T1 plus T2 minus K1 minus K2 has to be zero. That's conservation of overall momentum. The incoming T1 plus T2 has to equal the outgoing K1 plus K2. And that's the conservation law. So you just write this, we get a 2 pi. Yeah, this is exactly it. So we have minus I lambda, we get a 2 pi to the 4th, del 4 conservation of momentum delta function. Nice to see that emerge. There's actually some physics going on here. And then we have this denominator that's going to nicely cancel. We have the product over I equals 1 to 2 of the pi squared minus m squared, the product j equals 1 to 2 of the ki squared minus m squared. And those are going to neatly cancel with the same denominator in the factor that I just erased to write this. So we can write the it's a very simple thing. That's exactly the denominator on the other side. We set d to 1. We might have some factors of I floating around, but we basically got the whole answer here. And the simplicity of this answer may suggest why people do a 5 to the 4th interaction. QED gets a little messier than all this. But our transition amplitude then, T1, T2, with I, T, K1, K2. Okay, zeroth order vanishes. Order lambda, we're going to have all of this. This denominator is canceled. And I just want to check. I'm wondering what happened. Isn't there an I squared? Oh, there's an I to the fourth on the other side. Alright, remember the factor on the other side has I over P squared minus M for each thing. There are four of those, so we have I to the fourth is one. So there's no sign change. We just get exactly what we've got here. Minus I lambda, del 4, T1 plus T2. Minus K1 minus K2, and that's it. I left it 2 by the 4. 2 by the 4. So,
that's
a Dirac delta.
Okay.
The fourth power. So, actually, a fairly simple answer. Now, this is a transition amplitude. So this is a probability amplitude for K1 particles with momenta K1, K2 to emerge as
particles, P1, P2. We can draw this by having the K1, K2 lines coming in, but there's an interaction, and we symbolize the interaction by a vertex. So the contribution of the interaction Hamiltonian is to allow that single vertex to happen. And what can happen there is an exchange of momentum. In this particular theory, more complicated things might happen. In general, there will be some factors that come in. Here, the only factor is that minus I lambda. That's our coupling constant for the 5-4 theory, is the lambda. So it tells the strength of this. The fact that this transition amplitude is proportional to that lambda means that essentially that the probability of one scattering like this is of order lambda squared, because what we've got here once again is a transition amplitude. The probability goes like squared. So question.
So is lambda less than or equal to 1 then?
We're assuming lambda is small because we're doing a perturbation series in lambda. Now, if it's not small, you still can look at factors of 2 pi and some things that might make the overall calculation convergent. Just been looking at a paper that I should share with all of you so you can read the section that sometime in the next little while.
Yeah.
In a position to present that?
Sure.
Well, we'll have Jeff give a little presentation. There's a mathematical technicality in this whole perturbation theory that we get with path integrals. The perturbation theory is not strictly convergent, it's asymptotically convergent. And Jeff will talk about the difference between those. And this article, I need to post that article on the website so you guys can read it. It's pretty accessible. You know, it's just a mathematical thing. For absolute convergence, the limit of the series approaches the function. But in an asymptotic convergence, and I'm going to give a whole story here, but basically for a fixed value of x, the series will have smaller and smaller corrections. Up to a point, I guess. I'll let Jeff make this precise. What happens? If you add too many terms, it starts to diverge again. But you can actually get an assessment of how close you've gotten, I think.
Yeah.
Right? The correction terms up to a point are actually very, very small for many realistic situations. One exception is the strong interaction, where the coupling constant is on the order of 1, and perturbation theory just really doesn't do very well. And this is the reason that people do calculations with computers in Lattice QCD, quantum chromodynamics. You divide up space-time into a finite lattice of points, and if you had an infinite number of points, you could take a limit to a continuum theory, but on this finite lattice, you can actually evaluate the sum over history, the path integral over every path, because there's some large but finite number of these things. Well, these calculations may take months on a supercomputer, but you can do very accurate calculations in QCD by actually just doing the sum over all overall history, the exact path integral on this finite space. And that gives a good approximation to the whole thing. So there are other methods to evaluate these things when that coupling constant doesn't allow you to do perturbation theory. For something like QED, where that coupling constant is actually the fine structure constant, 1 over about 137, to get very good convergence, you know, up to how many orders there are in perturbation theory. You know,
I think it's the 20th.
10 to the 20th orders in perturbation theory. You're getting better and better and better. Each order correction is 100 times smaller than the last, so you can get a lot of significant figures before your perturbation theory breaks down. So we'll hear about that sometime in the next, I don't know, week or so. Yeah, I have to look ahead a little bit and see where we get with this. There are some generalizations here. Okay, the we draw diagrams like this, and looking at the amplitude of this, okay, we've got a 2 pi to the fourth and a delta function, so we get conservation of momentum. That always happens. You know, so whatever order, we conserve overall form momentum. We have a strength of minus I lambda in this case. That's the coefficient of all of that. And we actually write that on this picture to indicate that'll be there. What we're just beginning to develop are the Feynman rules. Okay, rather than go through all of this calculation, you know, every time you want to compute some scattering problem, what you can do is abstract what happens as a result of these calculations. And what happens is each time you have a vertex like this, your final calculation is going to pick up a factor of minus pi lambda. And you'll have a conservation momentum delta function. And you'll have some factors of 2 pi, a certain number depending on the order. So, you know, people have done lots of these things and have identified simple rules for writing the result rather than having to repeat the same calculations over and over. The propagator poles all cancel. And the, what am I missing? Connected graphs. Only connected graphs, I'll tell you what we're talking about there. Okay, for connected graphs, suppose we had 3 particles coming in and 3 particles going out. Well, one way to do that is to have one particle not participate and the other ones interact. And what you find is that this one that doesn't interact doesn't contribute to the amplitude. So diagrams that aren't connected, so there's not some interaction between all of the relevant particles. What will happen is these poles won't all cancel. You'll be missing one of these poles, and the result will be zero. So it zeroes out the non-connected graph.
So
yes,
the missing pole is the one that is not connected.
Yeah, it'll be that one that's up there. That's right. Let's see. That's probably not a bad spot to start. The one thing we haven't done here is the denominator. Let's see. Yeah, okay. Turning the page is dangerous. We'll get into more complicated interactions. For example, if we had phi cubed, we said that for phi cubed, you can't have 2 particles in and 2 particles out and do a first order correction of order phi cubed because you can't match up all the d's. But you can do 2. So in a phi cubed interaction,
what you can have is two particles coming in, but you can do two vertices like this and have two particles go out. So each one of these has three particles coming in. That takes care of three of your D's, three D's here, so you get six D's. The new feature here is that you've got this internal line. And that internal line is not measured. You're measuring these two particles, and calculating the probability of going from the one to the other. Well, you don't know how much momentum is transferred here because you don't measure it. So you have to integrate over all that internal momentum. Every possible value, you know, can occur. So there will be additional integrals when we have internal lines. We'll develop these rules, you know, just as we have time. We don't have time to start on a new thing today. The one thing, let me just see what he says about the denominator here. The effect of the denominator, so we're only looking at vacuum to vacuum graph. Let's see. We probably need an example for that. Okay, I'll talk about that next time. There's a way to take it into account. The denominator, we don't have it up here, but remember we had that vacuum expectation value of the interaction Hamiltonian factor, that e to the I integral of h. And so those are things like with closed loops where there are no incoming particles, there are no outgoing particles. It just starts with a vacuum, ends with a vacuum, but something goes on. You get little bubbles and things. And those we're dividing out. So we can include those in the numerator and then cancel them with the denominator. Basically, that's the kind of thing that's happening. So I'll talk about that in a little more detail next time. So, questions? That looks like your question. How about it, Joe?
Oh gosh, where do we begin?
Well, we'll be doing more examples. This is so far a long calculation for a little result.
I've got
the momentum.
that's a great result, though.
Well, it's reassuring that we do get something nicely physical out of this whole lengthy procedure. But yeah, go ahead. Is
the fine structure constant packaged in lambda somehow, or is that just a
remember? All of this we've done so far is for a scalar field.
Okay, so we're not dealing with that yet.
So when we do spinners, or when we do vector fields, right, the vector potential is a vector field. The spinners that couple electromagnetically. So QED is made up of one vector field and any number of spinner fields. And we'll develop rules like this strength of minus I lambda. Well, there will be a fine structure constant, maybe a minus I, fine structure constant times alpha, or no, alpha is, times a gamma matrix comes in as part of the formula. The point of writing terms like this in a graph is to tell you what to write somewhere along this point. You can go right to this answer. Once you've identified the Feynman rules. So you'll know what factor to put here. In this case, it's minus I lambda. You know how many factors is 2 pi to the fourth. You know to put overall conservation of momentum. There may be other things. Well, if you have spinner fields, you may have internal lines where you have to integrate over some further momentum. You may have integrations over the final positions, and often those are divided into, you do the radial integral and you leave the angular integral to give the scattering dependence on theta and phi. So you get the angular distribution of the final particles by not doing a couple of integrals in dS. Things like that. But what we're getting here is a matrix element, right? And to get the full scattering probability, you take the square of that matrix element. Well, the matrix element is going to be built up out of, there are going to be some Dirac matrices in there. And it'll turn out that when we square it, we can turn those into traces of Dirac matrices. So doing QED, you get a whole lot of practice making traces of Dirac matrices. But we need to develop those rules. Other questions? Sounds like the end. Okay. Go have fun.